center of Hiroshima was a reddish-brown scar 4 miles square. Between fallen buildings lay crumpled bicycles and shells of streetcars, halted in mid-motion. On piles of rubble and ash, children placed handwritten signs. Sister, where are you?
Three works which show what the people went through in Nagasaki and Hiroshima. Films, paintings made by children, an animated cartoon shown at Hiroshima every year. All this tonight on Alternative Views. Tonight on Alternative Views, we have some, well, pretty heavy stuff. Let me warn you that. We have three documentaries about the bombing of Nagasaki and Hiroshima. The first one is one which was actually suppressed by the Pentagon for many years. It contains film footage, black and white film footage, taken in Hiroshima and Nagasaki by Japanese. And it shows what went on there, how the people suffered. There also is some footage which was taken from inside the planes which dropped the bomb. The second documentary is one which came as a result of an interview we had with a fellow who was a half mile from the hypocenter of the Nagasaki explosion, and he lived to tell about it. The people who brought him here to the United States gave me, about 200 slides about the Nagasaki and Hiroshima explosions, and I put together some of those along with some Japanese music. The ones that I selected were ones which were pictures of drawings made by children and a couple of adults who went through the Hiroshima bombings, particularly the ones by children, and it's a chilling experience, as you'll find out later in the program. The third documentary is one, or at least a film. It's an animated one, which Dave and Casio Butts let us use earlier on a program, and it's one which is shown to children every year in school in Hiroshima. And it shows what it was like to go through and then gives a warning for all of us to be sure and not repeat such a horrible thing. But before we see these documentaries, we'll have some news stories.
There's the first article that I've seen that fully spells out the theory of nuclear winter that's been circulating recently in an article by Thomas Powers in The Atlantic of November of 1984 that gives a complete history of the theory of nuclear winter and spells out some of the scientific premises and data that support this theory. In a sense, he says, the bad news about nuclear war is so bad that it might be taken as grounds for perverse optimism, he concludes, that if people take seriously the theory of nuclear winter, this will indicate how totally insane even thinking about fighting a nuclear war or even a one-strike nuclear battle might be. Powers points out that in the 4 decades since Hiroshima, the speculative debates on nuclear war and the destructive effects of it have circulated more around issues of the fireballs around the war after the bomb is dropped or radiation from the bombs, whereas previously to 1982, he pointed out, no one paid much attention to the smoke that would arise from the burning rubble that would necessarily follow dropping any nuclear bombs on a massive scale. Then in 1982, the first reports trickled in about the theory of nuclear winter, that the airborne debris from the smoke and the rubble would block out the sun and would possibly kill all life on Earth because the temperature would plummet so rapidly, and agriculture and plant life and animals, etc., would die. And by 1983, the theory of nuclear winter was formally endorsed by scientists all over the world and has been further studied and documented. This theory points out, Powers indicates, that it would be impossible to win a nuclear war because even if only one side fired their missiles, still the nuclear winter effect that would be triggered off would be so devastating that the whole Earth would be destroyed. So he points out that the nuclear winter thesis, if valid, threatens to make nonsense of every notion the planners have managed to come up with in 40 years of trying to devise a sensible way to fight a nuclear war. This is the conclusion of his article. On a related theme, the Department of Energy, according to a report in Not Man Apart, has awarded an $85,000 grant to Robert DuPont, who's a psychiatrist and president of the Phobia Society of America that researches and reduces phobias. In this case, Mr. DuPont got a grant to study and to try to reduce phobias against nuclear power in the United States.
Oh my God.
He's published a booklet, Focus on Fear, that takes off from the premise that nuclear power plants are completely safe and anyone saying otherwise is phobic, and then tries to argue how neurotic it is to try to be afraid of and to worry about nuclear power plants. Unfortunately, there's not a word in Dr. DuPont's booklet about how nuclear power contributes to the arms race. He doesn't mention such near catastrophes as Three Mile Island or what would happen if one of these nuclear plants had a meltdown that's in the vicinity of a major city. He never talks about the economics of nuclear energy, whether it's even rational to consider nuclear energy, nor does he talk about the problem of disposing of nuclear waste. But it's incredible that the Defense Department spent $85,000 to fund this, which simply serves the interests of the nuclear power plants.
Well, people have been saying that the Democrats are pretty much bankrupt since getting drubbed by Reagan a couple of times, and even most Democrats agree with that. Well, after you see the article by Mother Jones, they talked to a whole bunch of prominent Democrats, and you can see why the Democrats are bankrupt. After hearing what they say, what is wrong with the Democrats? For instance, Gloria Steinem, who founded Ms. Magazine, she said the problem is that we've got to get women off of welfare and into working, and unions have to become more progressive. Deep thinking. Roger Wilkins, who is with Institute for Policy Studies and is one of the leading black leaders for many, many years, said, well, we have to have full employment. We've got to bring out the Humphrey Hawkins bill again. Person who wrote for Francis LaPaix, who wrote Diet for a Small Planet, said that progressives need to talk the language of human values in order to communicate with Americans. The right has claimed this high ground. I mean, Reagan's been talking about efficiency, democracy, freedom, and family, and shutting the liberals out. Well, she says, we got to start talking that good talk again. Jim Hightower, Texas Commissioner of Agriculture and a big person in the Democratic Party, says, well, there's no right or left anymore, only what works. And he says the main thing to do is, since all these New Deal approaches aren't any good, you've got to move people into the marketplace. Robert Kuttner, who's with the New Republic, says you have to have full employment. John Judas, a senior editor of In These Times, says basically give up all of any type of New Deal romanticism, like full employment. He's going the opposite direction. And so on and on it goes. One person from the Atlantic Monthly says the biggest problem is the debt and the deficit. Another person from Harvard says that the biggest problem is protectionism, too many tariffs. And then a Democratic representative from Massachusetts, Barney Frank, says the big problem is that all the various people gripe too much publicly. And he said Jesse Jackson, you know, should have kept his mouth shut. So the only person who seems to have any type of
of approach which may have some substance to it is Ralph Nader, who said that what we've been talking about is government, and nobody's been talking about corporations, and that's where the control of the economy is. And so if you can't blame the government. They said by focusing on the economic performance of President Reagan, well, he wins because he doesn't control the economy. Corporations do. Whereas the Democrats didn't focus on things like civil liberties, consumer protection, and in the environment, which Reagan was responsible for and which he didn't do a job at all. So you can see if these are the guiding lights of the Democratic intelligentsia, the Democrats are going to be in trouble for a long time.
I have an article here from the Wall Street Journal, and it concerns Ralph Nader and his latest experts in workplace safety. Now, government documents that he has forced the release of show that about 250,000 workers run higher than normal risks of developing cancer or other diseases from exposure to toxic substances on the job. These documents that he's obtained by way of his health research group identified 249 industrial plants and mines where workers have been exposed to potentially dangerous substances. For instance, he talks about 59,000 foundry workers who run the risk of various diseases, 50,000 miners, tens of thousands of chemical workers, and he goes on and on about that. Now, Ralph Nader charged that the government hasn't warned the workers of potential health risks so they could obtain medical care. In fact, in a letter to President Reagan, he accused the administration of withholding funds for worker notification programs because of concerns that workers would sue their employees. A spokesman for the Department of Health and Human Services says that companies have been notified and unions have been notified about the exposures, but plans to notify individual workers have been delayed while the government, quote, tries to figure out how to tell someone without scaring him to death. Now, isn't that real nice of them that they don't want to scare you to death by telling them that you might be dying? That seems very strange to me. Now, the Occupational Safety and Health Institute assembled its list in 1980 and 81 from government studies that linked a variety of workplace chemicals and other substances to cancer, heart, and lung disease and other ailments. The Reagan administration, despite all their denials of this, they've rejected budget requests for full-scale funding of a pilot notification program. Ralph Nader says he received a letter from a Health and Human Services official in November. It said, "We believe individual worker notification is an important issue." But then no explanation was given for the lack of funding for this program. Now, it's not as though that hasn't been tried before, the machinery is there to actually accomplish this. A pilot program run by the Institute in 1980, for instance, screened workers in an Augusta chemical plant in Georgia who had increased risks of bladder cancer from exposure to various chemicals. Mr. Nader cited an Institute study indicating that nearly half of the workers had never heard of this chemical, and 74% didn't know it was harmful. Of 586 workers examined under this program, 13 were found to have bladder cancer. Now here's the kicker. Government officials raised concerns about, quote, more than $300 million in litigation claims that have reportedly been filed because of the Georgia program, according to memos obtained by Mr. Nader. And now it all becomes very clear why they haven't gone ahead with this notification program, because they're afraid of the litigation. It might cost their business cronies some big bucks to save people's lives, and we just can't have that. In an instance like this, I think it becomes all too apparent whose interests the government's actually concerned with. What it boils down to in terms of lives versus profit, it's just not cost-effective to protect people's lives. That's all there is to it.
We've been showing on Alternative Views from time to time the attempts of the Canadian and other governments to curb acid rain, and have pointed out that the Reagan administration has done absolutely nothing to try to stop this virulent source of pollution. There's an article in the New York Times on February the 13th that points out that Canadian authorities recently have been imposing even more stringent regulations in an effort to cut back pollution, which in turn goes into the atmosphere and comes back as acid rain. So far this month, the Canadian government has toughened its emission standards for automobiles. Provincial environmental ministers in Canada have set specific overall goals for the reduction of pollution and have very detailed programs how they can cut back pollution in the various regions of Canada, so that, for instance, Quebec's cabinet ordered Norrenda Mines, which is Canada's second largest source of atmospheric sulfur dioxide, to cut back their pollution significantly. All of these efforts are a bargaining chip, the New York Times points out, for the Canadian Prime Minister, Brian Mulroney, who is going to be meeting with Ronald Reagan in Quebec City on March the 17th. In the past, the Canadian government has said the number one problem between the United States and Canada is cutting back acid rain, arguing that 50% of the acid rain in Canada comes from pollution in the United States, and that 10% of the pollution in the United States is acid rain from Canada. The Canadians are going to say, look, we've taken all these concrete measures to try to prevent acid rain and to cut back polluting the United States from Canada. Now it's your turn to do the same. Again, we'll see if Ronnie Reagan will come through. So far, the Reagan administration has done absolutely nothing to curb acid rain. Needs more scientific study, they said.
Yeah. It's curious, you wouldn't expect an article by Henry Gonzalez, the Democratic member of the House of Representatives from Texas, specifically San Antonio, a liberal senator, to be in the right-wing newspaper, The Spotlight. But ever so often, The Spotlight does present something from a liberal source, if it's something with which they agree. They've had George McGovern on their pages before, for instance, and Eugene McCarthy. Well, here Henry Gonzalez is talking about corporate tax, or lack of it. Remember, Craig's reported many times that back in the 50s, the corporations were paying as much as 30%. Of all the taxes, and now it's down to even less than 6%. And a survey of 250 major companies indicated that 51% of them paid no taxes at all, even though they're profitable. And Congressman Gonzalez pointed out that a group of six other companies with profits totaling $9.8 billion got Treasury checks worth $100 million and paying no taxes at all. Now, he goes in and talks about the difference in Japan. Japan has a booming economy. Does that mean they're giving no taxes at all, making no taxes at all to be levied on the corporations? Not at all. In Japan, the corporations are taxed at something like 51% of the profits when all the taxes are taken into consideration. And of the Japanese government budget, about 28% comes from corporate sources. Now, our corporations pay almost nothing in taxes, according to Gonzalez, while the Japanese companies pay $40 billion compared to $37 billion American companies paid, and yet the Japanese economy is only about a third the size of ours. So obviously, taxing corporations doesn't hurt the economy. Corporate tax breaks, by the way, cost the U.S. Treasury about $102 billion a year ago, and that's more than half of the present budget.
That's interesting.
And now we're going to see the first of the three films about the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The first one is called, simply enough, Hiroshima-Nagasaki, and it was one which was suppressed for many years by the Defense Department, so I'm told. And it contains actual footage of the event.
After 8:15, on the clear, bright morning of August 6, 1945, an atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, Japan. The pilots of the United States Air Force's 509th Composite Group could see flowers in the gardens below.
The bomb weighed 9,000 pounds and was as powerful as 12,500 tons of TNT. The bomb exploded within 100 feet of the target. The fireball was 18,000 feet across. The temperature at the center of the fireball was as hot as the surface of the sun. Near the center, people became nothing. Near the center, there was no sound. The light from the bomb flashed whiter than any white, like a sheet of traveling sun. Eyes turned up to the bomb melted. Within 9 seconds, 100,000 people were killed or doomed, and 100,000 more injured. Within 9 seconds, the city caught fire. Asphalt and steel burned like paper. Then the day grew black with smoke and dust. Over the city rose a cloud of smoke 40,000 feet high. 2 hours later, drops of black rain, the size of marbles, began to fall.
Remember, I remember. A bit like calm, very strong mind. I never see so strong. I do not know what has happened. My friend, she and I are always together, but I could not find her. So dark it gets, so red like a fire. All is smoking dark red. I cannot see anyone. Many people run. I just follow. Pretty soon like fog, red fog, then gray, and people down all around me. Many people look so awful. Skin come off, just awful. Makes me so scared, so afraid. I never knew such hurt on people, as human. I think if I'm in hell, it is like this. No faces, no eyes, red and burnt over things, like women's hair, dusty and smoking is burning. Many people go into the river. I watch them. Many people are drinking water, but they fall in and die, and they float away. Voices cry, calling names. I cannot hear because so many voices cry or call names. So many voices.
The light from the bomb created permanent shadows, burned into wood and etched onto stone. Leaves, flowers, and men disappeared, but their shadows remained. Doctors were killed. At the hospitals, between 3,000 and 10,000 people came each day for help, and each day, 2,000 of them died. They were buried together because there were too many to bury separately. People lived in the hospitals. They had no other place to go. The center of Hiroshima was a reddish-brown scar 4 miles square. Between fallen buildings lay crumpled bicycles and shells of streetcars, halted in mid-motion. On piles of rubble and ash, children placed handwritten signs. Sister, where are you? In Hiroshima, no one knew what had happened. Almost no one heard the Japanese radio announce that the city had suffered some damage from what was believed to be a new type of bomb, and details were being investigated. Still, the war continued. On a hot summer morning, calm, bright, and windless. At 2 minutes after 11 o'clock, another atomic bomb was dropped on Nagasaki, Japan. The descent lasted 40 seconds. The bomb exploded several miles from the target. In a single instant, 50,000 people died. Near the center, there was no sound. The cathedral stood 600 yards from the bomb center. Here, statues turned black. The Mitsubishi factory stood 900 yards from the center. Here, 6,200 men were killed or injured. The medical college stood 600 yards from the center. 198 faculty and students died. 238 were injured. The Nagasaki Penitentiary stood 300 yards from the center. 140 prisoners died in their cells. The Chenzai Middle School stood 550 yards from the center. Most of the children died as they sat at their desks. Yards from the center, trolley cars blew off their tracks. Passengers began to scream, and then the cars ignited and burned. At that same instant, onto the skin of some women were burned patterns from their kimono. After the bombing of Hiroshima, on the fifth day after the bombing of Nagasaki, the war between Japan and the United States ended. It was August 14th. On the 12th day, wounds that had not healed began to open wider. And on the 14th day, as they stood before their mirrors, women saw their hair come out in handful in their combs. Who had not seen sick before. They were vomiting, bleeding from the gums, and purple spots appeared on their skin. Some could not be touched because their skin slipped off in huge, glove-like pieces. At first, they were quarantined, considered victims of a mysterious infectious disease.
Gradually, it was understood that the disease was radiation sickness, and these people the special victims of the atomic bomb. Vegetation began to grow wildly in the wreckage of the cities. From charred remnants of plants, lush green weeds and wildflowers sprung again, madly, in extraordinary regeneration, stimulated by atomic radiation. And as people died of radiation sickness, the cities were blanketed with flowers. Robert Oppenheim, one of the inventors of the bomb, said,
"The world would not be the same." I remembered the line from Hindu scripture, the Bhagavad Gita. Vishnu was trying to persuade the prince that he should do his duty. And to impress him, takes on his multi-armed form and says, "Now I am become death.
That was in 1945. Imagine 2,500 of those atomic bombs exploding in one place at one time with a force of 31 million tons of TNT. Today, single nuclear weapons are being tested as powerful as this.
Doug, we've seen this documentary. It's certainly a very touching and chilling documentary. And as I mentioned earlier, it was suppressed for many years by the Defense Department. But now you've read a book indicating that a lot of information was suppressed over the years about these bombings.
Right. There's a very intriguing book called Shadows of Hiroshima by Wilford Bruchette, who is a war correspondent, who is the first Western reporter to go into Hiroshima after the bombing. Bruchette noted all sorts of horrible suffering, as well as the rubble
from the bombing and the fires that exploded after the bombing. He saw people breaking out in strange sicknesses, which later we now know are radiation sicknesses. He also observed that fish that were coming into the town and the river were dying suddenly as they came to the center of the city and were flopping around and suddenly died. And he began looking into this and discovered that there was a high degree of radiation in the bomb in the aftermath of Hiroshima. So he sent some reports out to the London Express, that was the newspaper that he was writing for, and suddenly began getting a lot of static from the American political and military authorities. They didn't want the public to know that there was such a high degree of radiation and that there was such a thing as radiation sickness. Moreover, they tried to manage the news by making sure that the only reporters that were allowed to go into Hiroshima after Burchett, who got in early through his own initiative, were friendly to the State Department and military line, so that, for instance, the early articles in the New York Times denied that there was any danger from radiation sickness or poisoning afterwards. And I think it's worthwhile reading a couple of these stories because it's fascinating as an example of how the government was able to manage the news initially about Hiroshima and the complicity of the New York Times, that's the most respected newspaper in the United States, and the reporter, W.H. Lawrence, was one of their top reporters with an expertise in science that just reported the lies that he was being fed by the War Department. On the 12th of September, Lawrence's report starts, "No radioactivity in Hiroshima ruin," and Lawrence writes, "Brigadier General T.F. Farrell, chief of the War Department's atomic bomb mission, reported tonight after a survey of blasted Hiroshima that the explosive power of the secret weapon was even greater than its inventors envisaged, but he denied categorically that it produced a dangerous, lingering radioactivity in the ruins of the town or caused to form a poison gas at the moment of explosion. He said his group of scientists found no evidence of continuing radioactivity in the blasted area on September the 9th when they began their investigation, and said it was his opinion there was no danger to be encountered by living in the area at present. Whereas Burchett, who was there, saw day after day new examples of radiation sickness were breaking out. The fish continued to die, etc. A few days later, the New York Times had another report that was datelined Atom Bomb Range, New Mexico. And the same reporter, William Lawrence, filed the story and said, "This historic ground in New Mexico, scene of the first atomic explosion on Earth and cradle of a new era in civilization, gave the most effective answer to Japanese propaganda. The radiation was responsible for deaths even after the day of the explosion, and the persons entering Hiroshima had contracted mysterious maladies due to persistent radioactivity. To give the lie to these claims, the Army opened the closely guarded gates of this area in New Mexico where they tested the bombs for the first time to a group of newspaper men and photographers to witness for themselves the readings on the radiation meters carried by a group of radiologists and to listen to the expert testimony of several of the leading scientists who had been intimately connected with the atomic bomb project." So this began a pattern of cover-up, and also a pattern that tried to deny that there was any danger from radiation poison or after effects of radiation, which now we know is total nonsense.
Well, obviously a lot of the scientists at that time knew about it, the ones, because it was certainly no secret from them. But you had a friend, Franklin Garcia, who was from Austin, and a longtime labor leader here, who was actually in Hiroshima in prison camp at that time. Was Hiroshima or was it Nagasaki?
I think he was a few miles outside of Nagasaki. Mm-hmm. He was a prisoner of war there, and they all heard the bomb drop and saw the explosion, and then discovered that they were free because the Japanese prisoner, the people running the prison
guards,
had all left, the guards. And so many of the soldiers went down into the town of Nagasaki bomb, and were immediately rounded up by American medical and military personnel who took them to Hawaii, where they put them in a restricted hospital area and gave them tests for about a month. So the scientists believed that there might be
danger and after effects from radiation. And we know from some documentaries we've shown on alternative views that throughout the 1950s, the government used American troops as guinea pigs to test the effects of radiation on American soldiers by dropping bombs and having U.S. soldiers enter the area. And we know now that many of them, a tremendous percentage of them, died of cancer, leukemia, and other diseases 15, 20 years after these tests.
I think it's also interesting the parallel what happened to the Soviet Union. In Leningrad during World War II, it was surrounded by the Germans and laid with siege for 900 days. And horrible, horrible suffering. Millions of people died of malnutrition, starvation, of bombing, of artillery shells hitting the city. And there are various estimates of how many people died in Leningrad. But there were more people who died in Leningrad alone than all of the casualties of the British and the U.S. armies during World War II. Mm. But after the war, the Soviets tried to hush-hush this and keep this information away from the Soviet people themselves so that they wouldn't know. And it seems to me what is happening is that the governments are wanting to soft-pedal all of this so that people will be more ready to go to war. They won't know the horrors of it. And so if the people don't know, and remember the interview we did with Dave and Kazuo Butts? She is, of course, they lived in Japan for a long time. She is Japanese. And they said that even in Japan, the whole thing is kind of downplayed. And they, in Hiroshima, they remember once a year. But the rest of the time, they kind of downplay what has happened.
Hmm. To round out and conclude Wilford Burchett's story, after he filed these reports indicating that there was radiation sickness and deaths happening after Hiroshima in the town, he was ridiculed by American authorities, and then he had his visa taken away, and he was sent out of Japan. He found that his camera had been confiscated, and all the pictures he took in Hiroshima were destroyed. The film was destroyed.
By the American authorities there?
Yes, and that he was thus a persona non grata in Japan. And finally, through much pressure from the British government, years later, he was able to return to Hiroshima. And this book, Shadows of Hiroshima, in fact, records the many trips that he took over the years to Hiroshima to follow up the effects of war and radiation on the Japanese people. And it's a very moving account of Burchett, of the tragedy of Hiroshima. So it's worth reading. It's by Wilford Burchett, The Shadows of Hiroshima.
Well, now let's see the second documentary or film, which is one which we made as a result of a interview which we had with a man who was a half mile from the hypocenter of the Nagasaki explosion and actually lived to tell about it. The people with him left us with a lot of slides and pictures showing what it was like to go through such a bombing. And particularly touching were the slides of the paintings which children made, children who had gone through, and a couple, some adults, but mostly children who had gone through the Hiroshima bombing. And I've made those into a presentation which we'll see now.
Thank you. That is something no other people, nobody apart from those who have already suffered from this should go through. And that is why I and other hibakusha of Japan are determined to work to the end of their lives for peace.
Our last documentary is one which Dave and Kazuo Butts provided to us. It is one which is shown each year in Hiroshima as part of their indoctrination to keep alive the memory of what happened in Hiroshima. It's shown to the school children there. Thank you. close our program tonight with short observations by peace activists Daniel Ellsberg and Dave Dellinger.
The Nagasaki bomb was a plutonium bomb, only now it's for the trigger of a bomb that's 1,000 times more powerful. The United States dropped, in all of World War II, 2 million tons of bombs, 500,000 in the Pacific, 1.5 million in Europe. We dropped 7.5 million tons, almost four times that amount, in Vietnam. That means 1 million tons a year, and 1 million is 50 times 20,000, so that was a Nagasaki a week, every week for 7.5 years. The 20 megaton weapon would, if it exploded with a full explosion, be more powerful than 3 Vietnam Wars in one weapon or 10 World War IIs. We have, they say, 9,200 other strategic warheads, not counting, as it's common to omit these, not counting the 22,000 little Nagasaki-sized weapons. Every president in every term of office since nuclear weapons were invented has considered seriously the imminent use of those nuclear weapons.
The East Germans and the Hungarians and a number of those countries have been indicating that they have been encouraged to take risks and to develop an independent peace movement because of the peace movement in Europe and the United States. Dresden demonstration last February, and the East German police did not dare break it up because it had so much popular support. People of all different ideas about tactics and methods and of different temperaments, but of the realization that unless we reverse the arms race, unless we start putting the money into human needs, the human race won't be here any longer. For the first time in human history, we face the possibility of total annihilation. Something new has been added, and war must be outlawed, beginning with outlawing armaments.
And that's Alternative Views for this evening. We'd like to thank our director, David Galasich, associate director, Alexander Stevens, Jr., people on the cameras, Richard Jones, Sandra M.P. McGann, Michael Ellis, and on audio, Randy Moreau. They were our crew at Austin Cablevision Studios. For our news section, our camera person was Eric Eubank, and Kevin West performed our audio function. The Austin Cablevision Studio supervisor was Peggy Little, who helped us out an awful lot, as of course did the fine people at Austin Community Television, ACTV, who let us use their equipment. Alternative Views is a production of the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. If you have any questions or comments about Alternative Views, there's our address. Good night.